health writers. John, can you tell us what Family Farm Defenders are?
Well, we're a national grassroots organization based here in Madison. We were founded about 15 years ago by basically disgruntled dairy farmers who were upset about the introduction of bovine growth hormone into the milk supply. And also they were concerned about the dairy checkoff, which many listeners have probably been exposed to the gut milk ads and other sort of funded promotions for dairy products. And this is a form of taxation without representation where farmers are basically, money's taken out of their milk check to fund these ads. And they were, many dairy farmers are concerned that these ads are basically promoting conventional industrial dairy products and not really supporting them. So that's how the group was founded. And since then, we've grown quite a bit to include all sorts of farmers from across the food spectrum. I mean, we have, you know, salmon fishing folk from Alaska who are members. We have maple syrup tappers in Vermont. We have all different types of farmers. And then we have a lot of members who are just consumers, people concerned about global justice, human rights, farm worker, you know, worker issues. So we try to be a group that works on a wide variety of issues. And our umbrella theme is food sovereignty, which I can get more into just what that is.
Okay. Before we go to that, do you also have people in other countries, or is it just basically the United States?
Well, we do have some members in Canada and Mexico, but we actually are part of a much bigger group called Via Campesina, which is the largest umbrella organization in the world for small peasant farmers, hunting, gathering, fishing, indigenous people. So through Via Campesina, we have all, you know, basically there's millions of farmers involved in Via Campesina. So that's our global international connection.
What is the greatest challenge to the small farmer in Wisconsin at this time, as well as, well, other states in the United States?
Well, I think our one of the biggest challenge for farmers in the U.S. is that we have a policy that basically doesn't support small-scale family farming. It supports a corporate agribusiness. And so through that policy, we have a food system that's designed to subsidize certain types of commodity crops. And then other farmers don't get a fair price in the marketplace for their products. It keeps consumers ignorant about where their food comes from, how it's produced, because if consumers know, they obviously would prefer to buy local fresh produce rather than something from China with melamine, but they're not allowed to know that. So the system's pretty much geared towards corporate agribusiness, small, you know, a small handful of companies controlling the food system, and farmers, both farmers and consumers, lose out in that process.
You know, Andy Ambler is here with us tonight. He's another one of the health writers, and he and I were watching a video that you were, it's on YouTube. And Andy came across this quote, and he wants to ask you about it.
The quote is, if we could combine organic, fair trade, buy local, and slow food, we would have a perfect food system. Can you elaborate more on this?
Well, I mean, a lot of people get involved in food politics or concerns about food from different angles. And one of our goals at Family Farm Defenders, we like to get all these people working together, because that's part of, you know, a holistic idea of food and health. I mean, that's why we call it agriculture. It's not called agribusiness. It's called agriculture for a reason, because it's such an essential part of human society and culture. And so when you look at, like, who's working on food issues, I mean, people are working at it because they're concerned about organics. They don't want chemicals in their food that are going to kill them or their children or their family. They're concerned about the whole issue of, you know, food coming from overseas, and they want to support local rather than, you know, having all these food miles. They're also concerned about our workers getting paid well. You know, that's the fair trade, one of the fair trade principles, a living wage for everyone, whether you're a farm worker or a farmer or anyone in the food system. You know, the barista at Starbucks, they deserve a living wage too. Everybody deserves a living wage. And then, you know, the final idea is slow food. And this is the, you know, and there's been movies made about this, books written about the problems with fast food. The idea that people no longer see food as like something that is fun. I mean, people see eating as like a chore, like it's drudgery. Like no one actually has a meal together anymore. And that's like impoverishing food. It makes food into just a commodity. It turns food into something that's not fulfilling or healthy or culturally, you know, relevant. So, I mean, that's the idea behind the slow food movement. It's like we should get back to eating. And we have whole restaurants in Madison built around this idea, like the new kitchen, which just opened at the old Cafe Mamont space on Mifflin there. The idea of, like, you should be able to actually sit down and enjoy a meal with your family and friends and know it's yummy food and talk about how you enjoy it together, not just pop in the microwave.
Well, that's a great idea. And this is the kind of conversation that you're not going to hear on commercial radio, because guests like John are not often invited onto radio stations like that. In fact, the kind of guests that you're going to hear a lot of times talking about agriculture or agribusiness are more like Alex Avery of the Hudson Institute Center for Global Food Issues, who's arguing that pesticides are not harmful and that it's all just been a bunch of propaganda. Well, that's what you're going to hear from the corporate radio. That's why it's so important that we have community radio. This is the radio that you support, and it's the voice of the people. And it only exists because you pledge to help support this radio station. So I'm going to ask once again, please call now, 256-2001. And we do have three pledges already. And I want to stress this. Two of the pledges that I'm holding here are really small, but they're just as important as the very large pledges that we get. I have a pledge here from Stephanie Gomez. It's for $1, and she's very, very happy that that we're on the air. Here's another one from Aaron. And it's a good thank you very much, Aaron. She is fond of In Our Backyard. Thank you for your pledge. And another one, I have to tell you, this is from my son, Lou Blank. Lou listens to our show. He's 11 years old, and this is coming out of his piggy bank. So if my son can do it, you could do it. 256-2001. Now, let's get back to John Peck. You know, I have a friend, and she is... She's been struggling with joblessness and homelessness, and she lives in southeastern Wisconsin. And she finally landed a temporary low-wage gig with Fair Oaks Farms in Pleasant Prairie, and now she's stuffing sausages that will be delivered to McDonald's. And I'm really glad that she has a job, but in a different society, I think she would have an opportunity to choose where she would give her labor. And I feel like now she has no choice. Isn't it a form of economic injustice to have these great big agribusinesses taking over the small farms?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's part of the concern about, you know, the food system right now is consolidating. I mean, we even had this happen just recently in our own, you know, region here, where we had Tyson bought out a pepperoni plant in Jefferson. People might remember this, and basically tried to bust the union there. I mean, the union exists, but they were forced to take concessions. You know, workers there, this had been a family-owned pepperoni plant, actually the largest pepperoni plant in the U.S., family-owned for, you know, decades, and then all of a sudden a giant multinational comes in, buys it out. First thing to do is try to, you know, destroy the labor rights that are there, force workers to take lower wages, reduce their benefits. I'm sure the quality of the pepperoni's gone down too. I have no idea, but they sell their pepperoni to giant fast food chains like, you know, Pizza Hut.
nice one.
And you know, Kraft versions of frozen pizza and so on. And so, I'm sure for the workers there, their quality of life's been diminished. That community suffered as a result of that takeover. And you see that all across the food system where, I mean, certain companies, you know, their whole goal is to turn good jobs into part-time temp jobs where no one gets full-time. I mean, no one at Starbucks works full-time, just so people know. They're all part-time workers, and that's for a reason, because they never have to pay overtime. They can deny you benefits. Jimmy John's, another place where, you know, people are trying to unionize at Jimmy John's right now all across the Midwest, right? So, you know, the idea of food sovereignty is not just for farmers. It's not just for consumers. It's for everybody in the food system deserves to you know, be treated fairly, have dignity and respect, get a living wage, you know, have some benefits. I mean, that's what's so encouraging for our group, because we work with responsible people in the food system. We work with a place like Cedar Grove Cheese. Okay, it's a 100-year-old cheese plant in Plain, Wisconsin, owned by that family for 100 years. All the workers there get a living wage. All the workers there have benefits. They buy all their milk from small grass-based dairy farmers. They try to pay the highest price they can for that milk. And that's a very different model of the food system. And what comes out of that is a fantastic cheese. It's very good. And people somehow think, well, we can't possibly afford to have a good food system. Well, you are paying for a food system that's not just. I mean, that's why people are getting sick from food contamination. And you know, how many people are forced to go to work at a fast food place even when they are sick, because they'll get fired if they call in sick, right? Mm-hmm. So they're sick serving you food that's full of sickness. And then we wonder why our healthcare, you know, we have healthcare problems in this country, type 2 diabetes, you know, and so on, so on, so on. But so that's, you know, if you want to have a good karma food system, part of that is by putting justice into the food system.
I'm going to change the subject just a little on you, John. You had mentioned earlier to me about nanotechnology. Mm-hmm. Why will that affect farmers? Isn't that basically for clothes and other things?
Yeah, I mean, this is the latest generation of technology being inserted into the food system, right? We first had biotech. That was the first wave, which we dealt with, genetically modifying organisms. We can talk about salmon. That's the next thing they're going to try to put on our plates. But now nanotech is also being introduced into food. And there's actually hundreds of food items already that we are eating containing nanotechnology. Like, people may have noticed that the frosting on cupcakes is whiter than ever before. Well, that's due to titanium dioxide. Okay, we're using over 2 million pounds of titanium dioxide in our food system now. It's a nanotech version of a metal that reflects light and has other compounds which they want to use in food. There's been no food safety testing done on it. The studies they have done on rats shows that it causes cancer and tumors, and we're already eating this stuff in massive quantities, plus it's in other items like you mentioned, clothes and other things. Why has that been allowed? How is the Food and Drug Administration supposed to be checking these things? They should be food safety testing done. They have not done it. Their argument is that it's substantially equivalent to other food items and that it's generally regarded as safe, which doesn't mean any food testing is required. So, and they're even trying to insert nanotech into the organic definition, trying to argue that nanotech is organic, so it's okay to use in organic foods. And we would be fundamentally opposed to that. We think, you know, nanotech should be banned. In fact, the European Parliament's planning to ban nanotech in all foods. That's how dangerous they think it is. But here in the United States, you know, our system's sort of built on, you know, ignorance is bliss. Don't let the consumers know. We'll just try to slip it in without anyone noticing. And that's why we're trying to raise the alarm bells about nanotech and the dangers, not only in food, but, you know, in healthcare products, clothing. And this stuff is going to bioaccumulate like any other toxin in our bodies and in our food system.
Isn't that kind of like what you have with toxic sludge, which they call it a bio...
biosolid or something.
Biosolid, yeah. Right? Yeah. And that apparently even, I don't know where it is on the organic, as far as the USDA organic thing is, but aren't they saying that is also organic, that people can use it on their farms?
They tried to insert that in the original rules, yes, allowing sewage sludge as an organic fertilizer, yeah, which we were able to defeat that, but that keeps coming up, is they're trying to, you know, water down, downgrade the standards. And this is a problem whenever you have, you know, the organic movement was created by people who actually cared about healthy food. And these are farmers who wanted to, you know, some of them had almost died from pesticide exposure. That's why they're interested in going organic. But then later on, of course, it becomes a huge market. And who's going to jump into that market? Just people who want to make money off of it. So, of course, they want the lowest standards possible for organic. And that's why you have companies like Walmart or Whole Foods going to China to source organic with very unquestionable standards, you know, rather than paying farmers in the United States a fair price for organic that could be produced here.
And what are the energy costs of importing foods like that?
Exactly. And that's part of the challenge, is how do you bring together, you know, people often ask me, well, is it more important to buy organic or buy local? My argument is, well, I think you should buy local first. Hopefully it's organic too. But yeah, I would not be interested in buying soybeans shipped from China if I could avoid
it. Sure, like Whole Foods has a lot of organic food, but where is it coming from?
Right. Right. And consumers should have the right to know that, which is another whole struggle. Is country of origin labeling has been passed in the Farm Bill multiple times. It was not funded under the Bush administration, so it wasn't implemented. Under Obama, now it's finally being implemented for fish and meat. People have all of a sudden discovered that their hamburgers are from Argentina, their fish is from China. They didn't know that before because now it's suddenly labeled. You know, 60 other countries have this right to see where their food comes from, and we don't. But, you know, it still needs to be applied further, like fruits and vegetables. Where does your dairy products come from? All those are things consumers have the right to know.
How has the new farm bill improved the small farmer, or does it not improve the the small farmer, particularly dumping of foreign, like we had mentioned before, of foreign imports of milk products, meats, and so forth on the U.S. market.
Yeah, I mean, the farm bill should really be called the food bill because it affects a lot more than just farmers. I mean, we have everything in the farm bill, such as, you know, what's all the nutrition programs, you know, the food stamps, which is a different program now, but all that's part of the farm bill. So what's in there? And yeah, I mean, there's some in the last farm bill, we were able to get some more money for, say, beginning farmers starting up. We were able to get more money for, say, being able to use food stamps at farmers markets rather than just at grocery stores. That was sort of a victory in the farm bill. More money to promote farmers markets in general. But at the same time, we're still spending over $100 million a year promoting ag exports to certain countries. So, like, why are we helping Kraft sell macaroni and cheese in Mexico with taxpayer money? You know, that should not be something we should be doing. Why are we using, you know, disaster in Haiti as a chance to dump Monsanto's hybrid seeds into that market and destroy their native seed industry? You know, those are questions which, you know, unfortunately, we're still subsidizing certain types of crops at an immense expense to taxpayers, which then corporate agribusiness benefits, and they dump those into not only into other countries, they dump them into U.S. programs too. So, you know, the school lunch program gets all sorts of subsidized commodity crops, which are maybe questionable nutritional value, but that's where they're getting dumped. Or they get dumped into the food banks through
the subsidies from the USDA. Right?
Yeah, through processed food companies and so on. So, I mean, that's part of the challenge too, is you have this system basically feeding itself off subsidies. It wouldn't be able to sustain itself without the taxpayer support.
Well, our listeners are really enjoying this conversation, John. Once again, thanks for joining us. Mm-hmm. We just got a pledge from Sue, who says she's a big fan of John Peck's. He does great work, and she wants one of these gift baskets. So she's made the appropriate pledge. That's a $60 pledge for that gift basket, which once again has Paul's 7-grain pancake waffle mix, a bag of Just Coffee, Fair Trade Coffee, Driftless Organic Sunflower Oil, Divine Milk Chocolate Bar, Krinky's Market Popcorn, Bauer Valley Maple Syrup, and a Family Farm Defenders bumper sticker. So thanks, Sue, for yours. And we've got a pledge from Uncle Andy, who is in the warm weather out there in Arizona. He wants Chris Hedges' book, Death of a Liberal Class, which you can get for a pledge of $50. So once again, call 256-2001 and keep Health Writers and WORT on the air. John, explain for our listeners what CAFOs are and how they affect our water supply and our long-term health.
Yeah, well, CAFOs are the sort of euphemistic term. It's confined animal feeding operation, but I prefer to call them factory farms because that's more what how I look at them. But basically what these are large-scale confinement facilities where lots of animals, whether it's chickens, pigs, cows, are basically put into a building, and then they are fed imported products. Usually most of these farms who operate these things don't grow the food that they feed to these animals. So they're mostly being fed soy meal, corn, a whole bunch of other things which we can talk about, which are problems for the food system, such as potential mad cow material, like blood and bone meal, tallow, plate waste. So all this is being fed into them. In the case of dairy cows, it's called a total mixed ration. It's a type of formulated feed compound. And the idea is then to maximize milk production or maximize meat production. In the case of the chickens, you know, they grow super fast. They can barely walk because their breasts are so huge because U.S. consumers want breast meat, or so we've been told. And so these operations have taken over much of our livestock production system. So you have some states now where there's literally thousands of these CAFOs or factory farms, like North Carolina for pigs, Iowa similar, parts of, you know, chicken farms are like this. And in Wisconsin, we have an immense expansion of mega dairy farms along this model, which has become very controversial. When I first came to Wisconsin, there were only two mega dairy farms in the whole state. This was 15 years ago. Now we have over 160. So this is not a natural phenomena. This has been promoted by the state. This is part of the state promotion of large-scale dairy operations. And so the problem now is you have certain communities in the state where literally people are drinking manure from their tap. Okay, if you go up to Kewaunee County right now, there are people living in the rural areas, and you would think rural Wisconsin would be pristine and safe from these type of hazards. Not at all. People have literally spraying 6 inches of liquefied manure 70 feet from their house.
Wow.
Going straight into the groundwater, and then they're drinking that, right? And then they do the well test, and sure enough, a quarter of the wells in Kewaunee County are contaminated with cryptosporidium, you know, which just comes from manure. I mean, we had a cryptosporidium outbreak in Milwaukee. So many people are familiar with what right. happens. Over 100 yeah. people died back in 93 from crypto in the groundwater, and that's due to fecal, that's due to manure contamination of water. We have fish kills, massive fish kills when these lagoons overflow or the runoff from the spraying goes into fish streams. We have the odor. And we're talking not just the stench, but ammonia and hydrogen sulfide, which causes migraine headaches, a lot of health problems. Kids' asthma grows up, you know, in schools downwind of these lagoons. So we have all these health problems, and the state continues to be promoting subsidizing expansion of these things. I mean, you can get grants up to $1 million to buy cows to put into your factory farm from the state, you know, plus, you know, other subsidies. And so our, you know, our concern, and then to add, to make it even worse, in 2006, the state passed a law basically saying local communities have no control. The state preempts all local control over siting of these. So even if you're a town or county, you want to have stricter regulations, you're not allowed to by the state. They will force you to accept these projects. And our concern is, well, what happens if they go bankrupt? I mean, this happened in other states, right? Indiana, one of these factory farms went bankrupt, and the taxpayers were stuck with a $400,000 cleanup bill to deal with a leaking manure lagoon. You know, what's going to happen when these go bankrupt? We already had some of them go bankrupt. Who's going to pay for that? Local people have to buy bottled water for the rest of their lives?
Well, it's just wrong from every aspect. Whether they go broke or not, it's unjust.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think it is that our state legislators have allowed such legislation to pass? It just seems unconscionable.
Well, we have a very powerful corporate agribusiness lobby. That's part of the problem. And we even see this revolving door, which we've seen at the federal level, where, you know, Monsanto executives like Michael Taylor move into the FDA, approve bovine growth hormone, or now he's back again under the Obama administration approving other GMOs. You have the same problem at the state level, right? You have the Dairy Business Association, which is a factory farm lobby group. You know, they're hiring former DACCAP employees, right? So, I mean, there's like this cozy relationship between industry and the regulators, which leaves out, you know, consumers and farmers.
What kind of headway is Family Farm Defenders making in terms of legislation and new bills, or just in terms of convincing people that there is a better way?
Well, I mean, one thing is we want to raise the alarm bell about these factory farm expansions, and we're hoping, depending on who the new governor is next week, you know, that the policy will be changing. We'll stop subsidizing factory farms in the state and actually start promoting local organic production, which is actually the fastest growing part of agriculture in the state. It's not factory farms. It's small-scale, grass-based organic operations. That's why we're the second largest organic state in the country after California. And that's not without, that's without any state help at all. The state's not been promoting that, right? So imagine if the state did start really promoting that. We had the Buy Local, Buy Wisconsin bill, which was passed a couple of years ago thanks to Senator Lassa, who's actually running for Congress up in Stevens Point now for Obie's old seat. She got that bill introduced despite the governor's initial opposition.
Good for her.
But we need more funding for that, right? So, I mean, there's a lot of efforts, you know, even at the local level here. How can we promote more, you know, local food in the schools? How can we get more community gardens? You know, why don't more cities have backyard chicken ordinances?
John, if people want to get involved in your grassroots effort and they want to join Family Farm Defenders, how can they get in touch with you?
Well, we have a website, which is familyfarmdefenders.org. They can also call us at 608-260-0900. We will also be having a booth at the Fair Trade Holiday Fair on Saturday, December 4th at Monona Terrace from 9 to 4, where a lot of these products will be available, local fair trade products. And yeah, we'd encourage more people to get involved because you are what you eat, and food's very important.
You know, we have just a few minutes left. We actually have three pledges that just came in. I want to encourage you to call. We're getting close to our the amount of money, our target. If you can call 256-2001 and show your appreciation, not only for the health writers who volunteer all their time and all the people here at WRT, but for our fabulous guests who come out here to share their knowledge, like John Peck, who's volunteering his time tonight at WORT. We're all volunteers. It's a community effort. Call 256-2001. And one other thing, if you want to join the Health Writers Collective, call the same phone number and ask for Glenn Mitroff, and he'll get you in touch with the three of us or the other health writers in the collective who are not here tonight. I want to thank Mary. She just called, and she made a pledge. She wants a T-shirt, the Wart and Peace T-shirt, and her favorite shows are Health Writers, Diaspora, and Tony Castaneda's 8 O'Clock Buzz. We got an anonymous pledge. I can't tell you who it's from. Someone whose favorite show is Health Writers and Labor Radio and Democracy Now. Thank you, Anonymous. And finally, Angela West has made a pledge. She wants the Family Farm Defenders Basket, and she thanks us for having John on our program.
Well, John, we're almost wrapping it up, but I'll just ask a real quick question you can answer. We haven't mentioned the Info Shop. Can you briefly tell us what the Info Shop is and where it's located and who can use it?
Yeah, well, the Madison Info Shop is a community resource center located on Willie Street in the basement of Nature's Bakery. That's 1019 Willie Street. And encourage people to come by and check out our fantastic lending library. We have a lot of great resources on food politics, for instance. People are interested in checking out a movie or a book or a magazine on that topic, and it's a great place to visit.
Well, John, we want to thank you very much. So, good evening. And for Health Raiders on the Air, this is Thomas Kozlowski.
And Steve Blank.
Andy Ambler.
And please visit our website at healthwriters.wordpress.com. Good night.
Thank you. I've been soaking up drink like a sponge. Don't you worry, get dressed, grab my mother.